I was toting my pack along the dusty Winnemucca Road when along came a semi with a high-end canvas covered load. If you're going to Winnemucca Mac with me, you can ride. And so I climbed into the cab and then I settled down inside. He asked me if I'd seen a road with so much dust and sand, and I said, listen, I've traveled every road in this here land. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the deserts bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. I travel, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Reno, Chicago, Fargo, Minnesota, Buffalo, Toronto, Winslow, Sarasota, Wichita.
Good evening, Vashon Island. This is the Cats and Jammer Follies, a travel tales show. And I am Megan Hastings, and we are on 101.9 KVSH, Voice of Vashon. Today we have on the show the brilliant mind, and body for that matter, of Kate O'Kane. She is an avid traveler, a hilarious actress, and a wonderful asset to this island. Today, she's going to share her observations of both traveling and living abroad. Her first story begins in China as a very young teacher of English. Kate O'Kane, welcome to the show, my dear. How are you today?
I am so well, thank you. Great to be here.
It's awesome to have you. And I just spent an hour with Kate talking about her fabulous life and all of her crazy. She's really a very established, not just traveler, but like all of her tales of working. Can you go into like a little bit about your, just
my background, where I came from? So I'm actually from a very small town in the north of England. Mm-hmm. And I think when I first went to Asia, I lived in China. A lot of people didn't even, I mean, they knew where China was, but it was like this weird thing that some girl from Wigan, the most famous thing about Wigan before that was that George Orwell wrote a book about it. And it was all about the degradation of basically the 1930s. But off I went to China at 18. But, you know, small northern town, trying to travel around the world. And I think in some ways, that's why I got so excited about travel, because...
Was to get out of Wigan.
Firstly, to get out of Wigan. But then the beautiful thing being knowing that Wigan was always going to be there for me when I came back. And I think one thing about travel is that if you've got a really strong foundation that you can come back to, it's always easier to travel. It's nicer to have that kind of home to come back to.
Absolutely.
And adventures to go on.
So, and your family is still there, correct?
My family's still there. Mom and dad are still there. And all the family friends. My brother's down in the south of England. And, you know, pre-pandemic, we would go back a couple of times a year. And the good thing as well is, because I've lived in some interesting places, mom and dad get to have pretty fantastic holidays wherever they go as well. They have no interest in me really coming back to the UK, because then where would they have, you know, to tell their friends about that they've been to on holiday?
So they really do like to travel.
They love to travel.
Did they inspire that in you, or that was you?
I think they inspired it. I think it was more kind of like a desire, because they hadn't had as many opportunities to do it.
Sure.
Mom had wanted to go to Canada for years. Dad was born in Germany, and so, you know, Europe was always part of our childhood. But when I went to China, it was my dad that put that idea into my mind.
Wow.
You know, it was something that he was obviously interested in, and me having no original ideas of my own, I just sort of went, yeah, Dad, that sounds like
that
a good idea.
Hard to believe.
Yeah, let's go. But they came and visited me in China quite a few times.
That's awesome.
And Botswana, and here in the US, they've been to Vashon two or three times already. So,
well, I look forward to meeting them if they come again soon, post-pandemic.
Yeah, I hope so.
Well, Kate, I'm going to let you share your story with us and the listeners.
Thank you. So this one's set in China in 1992. And there's this amazing festival that takes place every Chinese New Year in Harbin, which is up in the very far northeast of China in Heilongjiang province. And it's called the Ice Lantern Festival. And at that time in 1992, it was this small, kind of quirky, but yet still phenomenal festival where forbidden cities, small ones, not like the main one, and temples were built from slabs of ice and then illuminated with all these colored lights inside. My friend Maxine, who I was sharing my gap year with, and I, we were living down in the very south of China, teaching English to university students. And when I say teaching, I mean we were 18-year-olds with no formal teaching training, standing in front of students every day and essentially just talking the language we'd spoken ever since we were born. I'm not sure we were the most effective teachers, but for most, we were the first foreigner they'd ever seen, with a big nose, white ghost skin. And we were actually called Guelos in local Cantonese dialect, which just means ghost person. So we'd spent 5 months teaching and standing in these hot and humid classrooms. And so an ice festival seemed like a really good place to be. And we jumped aboard a ship in Guangzhou or Old Canton. We sailed up the east coast of China, stopping for a night in Shanghai. And funnily enough, it was a city I hated on that trip because it was so busy, it was so noisy. But then I grew to love it immensely when I lived there for 5 years, a decade or so later. We then went on to Qingdao, which you may have heard of Qingdao beer at your local Chinese. And we finally got off the ship in a place called Dalian. There wasn't much to do in Dalian except go to the Dusty Natural History Museum as we were waiting to go on land further. And a guy on the boat we'd met was going to take us further to get a direct train to the ice festival. But first, we were invited to visit his family. So we were dressed in these Chinese Navy winter coats. So, you know, now China is the place where fashion is being made. But in 1992, there wasn't the same fashion industry. And so people would buy military surplus coats to keep warm. Most people had the green ones, which were for the People's Liberation Army. But we had lucked out and we'd found a naval shop in Qingdao. And so we had these super fancy blue People Liberation Navy coats. And it seems odd now because I'm the wife of a retired US Marine and I'm the sister of a UK naval commander, but I really was the first one in my family to wear navy blue in a formal sense. Anyway, decked out in our Chinese Navy winter coats, we jumped onto the truck that the guy had got and we'd met him basically on a slow boat going up the coast of China and we went off to visit his family. And this was our first experience with Chinese rural life. The home was built around a courtyard. It's probably similar to what people would have seen in the movies. You know, there was chicken and hay on the floor. There were rooms leading off the courtyard. No one spoke any English apart from the guy we'd met on the boat. And of course, no one in his family had a clue why we were there. A family dinner was being prepared. It was Chinese New Year, and we were the new guests of honor. Megan, you won't like this, but a few animals were killed to mark our arrival. We had chickens being chased through the kitchen. To basically be our meal, and neighbors had come from close and far to basically stare at the foreigners. And I think it's hard to imagine now, but many Chinese people in 1992 really didn't know what a non-Asian face looked like. On TV, you know, it really just showed Chinese news and cultural programs. The majority of visitors to the country were from Japan or Southeast Asia, and so a white or a black face was very rare. So it wasn't uncommon to have our noses poked and our hair stroked and certainly in our cases, our breasts ogled. Dinner was finally being served. And at this stage, Granny came into the room. She was an old lady, sort of bent over, and she hobbled. She was helped up onto the kang, which is a heated bed or platform that you would find in northern Chinese homes. So imagine a wooden platform with bricks, heated bricks underneath it. And the families would sleep there, they would eat there, they would relax there. Granny took her place and we were invited to sit on either side of her. And it was at this stage that I noticed her feet. They had been bound when she was a child to make girls and women walk more delicately, supposedly, but really it was another form of torture that we've inflicted on women for centuries. It was banned in 1911 in China by the New Republic of China government, but I imagine it carried on in rural areas which remained more traditional for years. So Granny must have had her feet bound as a young girl. This was 1992 and she must have been in her 80s or 90s. So I can only presume she was one of the last to have this happen to her. She was charming in so many ways with an amazing wide toothless grin. And as I think about it more, I think about all the lives she must have lived. You know, she was there when the last emperor was there. She was there for the founding of the new People's Republic of China, the Cultural Revolution. Charming, interesting, but I'm pretty sure picking your bound feet toes while sitting next to guests is not going to be good etiquette anywhere. After meeting Granny, we traveled on to Harbin. We saw the lights. They were pretty. We skied down a 60-foot slope. We ate caramelized crab apples. And then we wondered, what else are we going to do? And then, as only two 18-year-old girls on the other side of the world can do, we had a great idea. We're so close to Vladivostok. Why don't we go to China, into Russia? You know, obviously that was a good plan. Our trusty Lonely Planet Guide to China, the second edition, told us we could go to Sufenhe, right on the border. And from here, trains would take us to Vladivostok. What it didn't tell us was that Sufenhe was the center of the Russian black market trade with China, that it was freezing cold, and that there would be nowhere to stay. We still planned to write and tell them to change their description. We arrived in Sufenhe and were grudgingly given a room in the one hotel. Three beds against walls. And I forgot to mention that we'd also picked up a fellow traveller by this stage. He was a German guy named Ronald. He had the green army coat and had crazy wild hair. We bedded down for the night with our clothes on because the room was freezing. At about 2 a.m, all the lights in the room were suddenly turned on. The owner marched in. I was basically forced out of my bed, and my bed was lifted up. The floorboards were lifted out. 2 frozen chicken carcasses were removed from the floor. The floorboards and bed were replaced. The lights turned back out and the door closed. We were literally sleeping in the freezer. The next day, after oddly sleeping fine, we went to the train station. Here, at least, they were used to seeing foreigners as Russians roamed the town buying cheap Chinese goods to take over the border. But they hadn't seen UK or German passports before. We were waved away a number of times as we tried to get an exit pit permit for the country and also a train ticket. But eventually, a Russian guy named Alexander told us this was a free border and we could just jump on the train. So we did. Eventually. The train was made for working with platforms, so there were no stairs below a certain height. I was lifted like a doll by some Russians onto the train. Maxine and Ronald, who were both around 6 foot, fared a little better. And we were invited to join Alexander and his group in their cabin, by which I mean they had created a cabin out of placing boards across the top bunks of the sleeper carriage, and 6 of them had piled into the seats below. Above on the boards were bundles and bundles of goods heaving out of the space. The toilet next door was filled with goods too. The entire train was filled with goods around which humans could potentially morph themselves. And these humans, all called Alexander in some way, Alex, Alexei, Sasha, there may have been a Vasily, but genuinely everyone seemed to be called Alexander. Anyway, these Russians, there was alcohol. It was cold. Now again, you'd think Russia, you'd think vodka. Well, you'd be right. But remember, these are black marketeers, so it was Chinese vodka and Russian whiskey. I was no innocent 18-year-old. I grew up in the UK where pubs were a lot more lax about serving teenagers, and so I'd had one or two drinks before. But wow, this was drinking on a whole new scale. About 3 hours in, I needed to go to the loo. If you remember, the loo was already filled with black market goods. So Alex 2 or 4 suggested I go down between the carriages. Maxine would come with me and hold the doors shut. This plan clearly made no real sense, but there had been vodka, Chinese vodka, which may as well still really be grain fermenting. Needless to say, I managed to slip on the ice, fall while peeing, and cause only a small international incident. Back to the carriage, and suddenly we were in Vladivostok. We think. We're still not really sure to this day where we were. We got off the carriage, our new Russian fathers, brothers, and uncles danced us up the platform to meet the border patrol. This side of the border was a little less friendly. The details are somewhat sketchy, Chinese vodka, but I remember being interviewed by one as my name was easiest to say. I was Catherine the Great. My friend Maxine was too close to Marx, didn't want to talk to her, and Ronald, well, Reagan was still too much of a Cold War enemy at this time. We were told we were going no further and put in the watchful charge of Timotei and Ruslan, two incredibly handsome Russian soldiers who had actual Russian vodka. We drank with them, snoozed a little, and then were finally placed back onto the train, first class, to Sufenha. I'd love to say our troubles ended there, but on arriving back formally into China, it transpired that we had another issue. Our passports, which we'd been told didn't need exit permits, showed we'd never left China. But yet we were here on a train from Russia. So once again, no one knew what to do with us. So we took it into our own hands. We opened a door, walked through a gate, and went back into China. A few days later, we were in Beijing, asking for our friend Dominic, who works for Carlsberg at the British Embassy, and bowling at the American one. But, as they say, that is a whole other adventure.
China girl, I feel a wreck without my little China girl. I hear her heart beating loud as thunder, so many stars crashing. I'm not mess without my little China girl.
So you see, I did not lie when I said this woman was hilarious. Kate, that's one of the more accomplished crazy stories that we've had on here, and I fully enjoy hearing it again and again.
I swear my parents were probably not going to be that happy that I've told it, but there we go.
Well, you'll definitely have to have them listen to it once it's on. wild times for you as a youth. I love it. I want to talk about a couple different things, but one thing that I do want to talk about is the bound feet. And how is it that, I mean, I've seen pictures of them from growing up or whatever, but like, how is it that they were expected to be more dainty when they couldn't even walk?
I think that was part of it, really, is that they then, because they were hobbling, they would then need to lean on a man. And so there was almost that sense of women being the delicate ornament that needed a man to lean on was part of the whole mystique of it. I mean, obviously, it's really torture.
Oh,
and it's disgusting.
Horrible. Were most women's feet bound?
It was very much
point?
An upper class
an
kind
upper
of like, you know, gentility kind of thing. So again,
well, the lower class woman would have had to work.
Yeah, exactly. But then again, that makes me wonder again. I mean, I wish I had enough Chinese to speak to Granny and find out more about her story, but she must have come from quite a privileged class. But then with the Cultural Revolution in China, with the, you know, communism taking over, but she must have been, you know, she was living in Manchuria, where the emperor was from. She would have lived through the Japanese invasion of Manchuria. She must have had the most incredible life.
Could you imagine if you would have had the language at that point to, you know, it's interesting, the things that you would have think to ask now wouldn't necessarily be what you would ask when you're 18.
I think, exactly. As an 18-year-old, it was more kind of, you know, like, ooh, bound feet. And now, you know, even thinking about it before we were speaking, just the amount of lives she had lived and the ways in which she had seen her country change, it would have been fascinating to know.
Yeah, what an amazing creature. Mm. And then, of course, I want to talk to you just for a moment about how you almost killed yourself.
Peeing in between, I mean, it... You know, it's funny.
Your parents would have been proud. Oh,
well, yeah, exactly. You know, and trust me, I've peed in many places since, all legally-ish. But it's that kind of thing I think you do when you're 18, you know, years to come now. I'm as well like, how did we think it was a good idea? Any of this?
I mean, any of it.
You know, I mean, I literally was lifted up like a toy onto this train. And then we're like, oh, yeah, of course we'll sit in this carriage with 8 Russian black marketeers. And, oh, I
have
to
be honest, I would have done the same thing.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of, I think, you know, part of travel is finding the right balance between total naivete and a little bit of experience. But I think sometimes the more experience you get, the less likely you are to go and have the experience.
Well, that's just so it. You have to do it when you're young. I always say that because the things that I would do now versus then there's no way, you know, and I'm glad that I did it. I'm glad you did it.
Yeah.
I'm glad you're here to talk about it.
Exactly.
And now we're going to go to another country that our lovely Kate has spent time in, and it's about India.
Yeah. So India was a very different experience. I was much older.
How many times have you been there?
I've been very fortunate because my job took me to India a lot as well. So, you know, we're in double figures, but it's an amazing, beautiful place.
And but I think every time, I'm sure it's just
it's different and amazing and vibrant. And, you know, I'm conscious right now that they are having significant struggles with oxygen supply and COVID. Yeah. And so, you know, my heart goes out to friends and family there. And, you know, I just hope that they get back to those more magical times for themselves. So.
Absolutely. Yeah. Good thoughts for India right now. It's terrible.
So India, and when I was thinking about this story, I really went back to the first time I went there, and it was when I was on my way back to the UK after living in Shanghai for 5 years and before I moved to Botswana. So I don't know if I can get more countries into that sentence, but I'll try. And so I have been lucky to go there a few more times, but this story is really more an amalgamation of my thoughts. So pretend it's a travel journal. So far, it's been a fabulous time, filled with long, dusty days at camel fairs, princess moments of the trying on the tiara type, not the hissy fits, in gem palaces in Jaipur, and romantic sunset boat rides around lake palaces. Rajasthan is everything and more than I was promised. Coming from China, and all that I know and love there, many of my initial ideas spring from a comparison of the two places. They're both big. They're both struggling to come to terms with a new influx of global power, and both home to more than 1 billion people. Most telling of the differences is the way the world works. India's chaos to China's order, no doubt brought about due to the fact that everyone in India has a say and generally does. Chinese drivers are driving gods in comparison to the anything-goes style of Indian roads. Abdul, the self-titled beeping Muslim taxi man who drove me from Pushkar to Udaipur, went to great lengths to tell me about the corruption in the Indian government and the fact that anyone with 500 rupees could get a driving license. He seemed to miss the irony in that whilst he was telling me this, we were overtaking a lorry and a car on our side of the road, whilst a lorry and a bus were heading towards us on the other. Add along to this the ever-present holy cows who just sit wherever they please in the road, and it's a wonder that a billion lives still exist here. Much has been made more recently of the growing disparity between rich and poor in China, and how that's going to affect change and progress moving forward. Indian society is undergoing the same changes, as the caste system, religious differences, and regional relocations bring the rural poor into the towns and cities, where mobile phones ring, cars and motorbikes rule the road, and cows are often fed better than people. The buildings here do truly amaze, whether it's the 50-plus temple ghats surrounding Pushkar's spiritual lake, the intricate facade of the Hawa Mahal in Jaipur, built so that the royal women could stare but not be stared at whilst covered, or just the simple homes in every town along the way. At first, all of this reminded me so much of the buildings in Seville and Granada, palaces built just like here by long-deceased rulers and despots. And then I remembered the spread of the Mughal army and the Persian Empire, and it spread east as well as west. Alongside this architecture sits the Victorian clock towers and the stunning old schools and clubs of the British Empire, showing us that whatever people may think, the world is actually quite flat. Even before the creation of email, cell phones, and Bombay call centres, influence and culture spread their way across the globe. I was just about to go and work on a HIV/AIDS programme in Botswana, and so I was probably more aware right then for the need for safe sex. So it was intriguing to see STD clinics advertising their work on every street corner. Luckily, before I ended up believing that India has an even bigger problem than it does, the telephone lines made it clear that this service provided state telephone dialing, not sexually transmitted diseases. But it was another intriguing moment of how the use of English across the world can often cause as much confusion as clarity. I was also introduced to the game of sardines at a house party years ago. For those of you who don't know it, it's like hide and seek, although everyone has to cram together into the smallest place possible. I thought we'd got quite good at it then, but my friends and I have nothing on the canny Indian family. Travelling in Southeast Asia had also allowed for the colourful sight of mum, dad, and a couple of small kids on a scooter. But in India, they take this to the next level, with a family of five on the back of a ramshackle motorbike. The five are led at the front by dad. Behind him is teenage kid number one, then grandpa in his orange turban, then teenage kid number two, and then mum bringing up the rear safely. I thought this was impressive, until I saw the next group. Six grown men in a Maruti Suzuki, which is approximately the same size as a Fiat 500. Three in the back, three in the front. Who knows where the gear stick went, because I can only hope it was an automatic. From Rajasthan, I travelled down south to Kerala. And interestingly, and not to dwell too much longer on the China-India connections, Kerala seems to be the only place in the world where communism has actually worked as it was originally transcribed. The state democratically chose a communist government in 1957, and from reports I've read, there is education, healthcare, and work for all. Yep, there are some rich Keralans around, but there does seem to be a much more egalitarian distribution of all the good things in life here, and less of the chaos and befuddlement I've seen in the north. India is evidently the most democratic nation in the world with over 300 political parties. That was in 2008. I did a more recent Google check and it now puts the number at around 2,500, which goes some way to explain their inability to get a true majority in parliament or even a singular party view. Of course, the essence of true democracy is one that we can't actually get everything agreed. And so academics are saying this is the reason why India stays as it is rather than moves forward at the pace others have done. It was while I was in Kerala that armed men ran riot in Mumbai and killed 165 people. So it wasn't surprising that I felt the need to write about faith and an individual's beliefs and actions. Kerala is many miles from Mumbai in terms of language, culture, and development. There are palm trees instead of high-rise skyscrapers. There are dhoti skirts for men instead of suits. Yet here, as in Mumbai, Karachi, London, and Washington, people of many faiths live together. the strong community of Christians who hold Mass every Friday night on the local beach, under an immense neon cross, a beacon for their faith, and a sign of home for the fishermen who make much of their community. A smaller community of Muslims, fishermen as well, who call themselves to prayer at around the same time at their mosque, which is being built one minaret each year as they can afford it. On the main road, there are Hindu temples, each to one of their myriad gods, appearing every few hundred yards, so that daily pilgrimages to ensure all gods of worship can be done on the way to and from the market. And then there's the beckoning spires of the Syrian Christian Church and the Catholic cathedrals of Trivandrum nearby. As Sanjita the Wise Lady, well, she's the same age as me, but she's been married 16 years and has 4 kids, so much wiser than me. She says she's a Christian, her sister is married to a Hindu, but her mother has now adopted the Jain faith. Many in her community believe that these faiths are all essentially the same thing, centered on a belief that life comes from somewhere and that our actions are answerable to someone or something. As long as you're guided by a faith in yourself and your brother, man, or woman to do the right thing, a faith in the innate goodness of others that they will do you no harm, then life is as it should be. And so it was this faith in myself and in those around me that I continued to carry with me when I traveled the world, because I believe that once that is gone, and we start to regard anyone who thinks differently as a danger, then those who committed these crimes in the name of their God will win.
I got handed an Ayn Rand sandwich straight from the can. It tasted so bland. I asked a lass to pass me a glass of equals conditions of the working class. Right away they dragged me to the committee to explain my un-American activity. They're gonna say they made a in their beaver hats and the fascist happy athletes, but I don't care for the athletes. What I care about is music, and the communists have the music.
Kate, that was so beautifully written.
Thank you. It's interesting to go back to it years later and sort of remember how it felt to be in Kerala when things were going on in Mumbai, and just the way that it changed so much of the way I was traveling at the time.
Oh, I can imagine. Yeah, I mean, you bring up many emotional points in this story about India, and it is and your life, and it's so it's poignant and beautiful and sad and thought-provoking and all the emotions that should come along when you are traveling.
I will say I went back to Mumbai years later with work, and it was as busy and as joyful and as beautiful and as chaotic as I remember it. So Things continue.
When all this opens up, where do you think you'll go to next?
Oh, so many options. I mean, I want to get back and see mom and dad. That's the first thing in the UK. It's been 15 months since I've seen them, and that's a really long time.
It's a really long time.
But, you know, I've never been to anywhere in Latin America or South America. I'd love to get back to Africa. I'd love to get back to Asia. So many places and so many friends.
I have a feeling that you're going to see it all.
I hope so.
While you're on this planet. Thank you so much, Kate O'Kane, for coming on. This is Megan Hastings, and this is the Cats and Jammer Follies.
I've been everywhere.